What is up? It is your boy Cassio, and you are watching the Monday Mailbag with Mr. Nick Patrick, the man, the myth, the legend. How are you, sir?
I am doing great, man. How about yourself?
Always good, man. Had a great Easter weekend and look forward to talking to you here today. A lot of big wrestling news. Just came off of Mania Week a couple weeks ago. Big sale. And we're going to get into that. So we got a lot to get to from the listeners. If you're ready, I'm ready. You ready to attack the questions, Nick?
Yes, sir. I'm ready.
Let's go. Let's ring the bell. Here we go. Darren, DareBear1, he tweeted us at Ad Free Shows and said, Nick, was your height something that affected you as a referee since the norm is shorter than wrestlers? So for just to set it up a little bit, I think maybe for some people that might maybe not know, they usually lean towards smaller refs because it makes the guys and the girls look better. Is that true?
It may have turned into that now.
Okay.
But back when I first started, it really wasn't that so much, you know, and when I started, I was really one of the smaller guys, you know. I started, when I broke in Central States, it's up in Kansas, it was based out of Kansas City. When I first started, I was just a little guy, man, trying to pump up, and you know, I was referee size. I wanted to wrestle, you know, so I was lifting. But height, no, it never really was an issue, you know, ever. Even because I worked with everybody, you know, the giants and the shorter guys too, you know. But I just handle it different, you know. The big guys, you get up in close, so like. I explained it one time when somebody asked me a question once before. I wouldn't like when I'd raise their hand at the end in victory, I wouldn't like try to stand right next to them. I'd stand a couple steps away and raise their hand, you know. So, you know, there were little things you could do, you know, to be conscious of it, but it was never a problem. No promoter or nobody ever said anything, you know, or ever had a problem with it for that matter.
They never said, hey, you can't work with these two guys. I mean, because you worked with a lot of cruiserweights.
No,
especially in the WCW era.
No, I never had that problem. Well, I think they liked me because I could remember a lot of things. I had good timing, and you know, I could always be there for whatever they needed. And like I said, size just never really wasn't an issue, you know, because a lot of the smaller guys too, you know, especially the guys that I worked with, they were like, they had that attitude. Well, y'all will mess with me and watch me grow. So the size was not a really a huge thing. You know, I just, you know, just be conscious of it and try not to stand over someone, you know, but that was basically it. And basically it was only when I was in close to them that I would, you know, I would bend over and do something, you know, like if they were in the corner, I would try not, I'd kind of like lean in, like I was trying to break something up. And it was just little things, you know, and it really wasn't a conscious thing.
Did somebody tell you to do that, or did you just
I just kind of did that on my own, you know, cause it was always a referee's job to help present the talent, you know? And I just, you know, it was just my idea because I had thought of that myself, you know. It was a question that had come across my own mind. So I thought, well, you know, I can do this, you know. It was a simple little solution. Just stand a couple steps away from a guy when you raise your hand and you're not standing right over the top of them, you know. You know, little things like that. But that was all the stuff I come up with. And no, I've never had anybody complain about it or tell me, no, don't do that match because you're bigger than those guys. That never happened to me.
All right, Lauren Eason wants to know, I'm not sure if this has been discussed, but did Nick ever consider being a wrestler? Lauren, first of all, we have discussed it, but no biggie, because that means you're listening to us, and we appreciate that. Nick, you've covered it before, but just in case we've got some new listeners, which we're glad we got some new listeners, talk about how you kind of transferred from, you were actually a wrestler first, and then went to referee.
Actually, I was a ref first. I started off when you were little.
You're ring announcing when you were a kid.
Ring announcing in the fifth grade. Yeah, but I started reffing first right out of. I went to college for a year, and I started while I was in college. And I come back and I started reffing for Georgia Championship Wrestling, and I didn't start wrestling until Georgia Championship ended up being bought and taken over by Crockett, you know, after the Black Saturday and all that, and Ole and Barnett split. And next thing you know, Crockett was in control and of that. And I had started wrestling at that point. I always wanted to wrestle, but I did start off as a referee And in 1984, I actually started wrestling. I wrestled for a little over 2 years before I blew my knee out really bad. I started wrestling locally on the Georgia scene. It was, you know, independence wasn't huge back then. But there was a couple of small promotions, Skunkle Enterprises, and, you know, a couple of other little small ones. But that I started because Georgia Championship. I knew that when Crockett bought it, they wanted me to go back to being a ref, and I didn't want to travel as a ref all through the Carolinas. And I was ready to start wrestling. Is what I wanted to do. So I worked independent for a little bit, and a spot opened up for me to go down to Continental, the Pensacola territory. It was very unfortunate. Tommy and Johnny Rich were teaming up, and I guess they went to a party or something. They were somewhere, but a fight had broke out, and Johnny was covering Tommy, and somebody stabbed Johnny. He got stabbed like several times, and he was out. He was part of a babyface group they called the Rat Patrol down there. And so now Johnny's out, and a spot opened, and I was doing a couple of little local indies around Georgia and wasn't really happy. I was looking for a place to go. So my dad was down there wrestling as the Flame, and he said, "Hey, Nick's open. He could come and fill that spot in if you need somebody, you know, to fill it in. He could be here next week if you needed him." And so they called me, and it opened a spot up for me. And I went down there, and I worked as with Steve Armstrong and Scott Armstrong as one of the Rat Patrol guys for just a short time.
Rat Patrol.
Until Johnny was up and ready to come back in. And then from there, I went to wrestle for Bill Watts out in Louisiana. And I was out there for a little over 6 months. And that's where I blew my knee out really bad. And I had to get out of the business for almost 2 years before I broke back in. When I come back in, actually all the time I was with Deep South, I never got in the ring. I did, you know, Pop and I started Deep South while my knee was messed up. Yeah. I was doing commentary and promoting and helping, you know, train people at the school, but I wasn't really getting in the ring. I was just, you know, kind of coaching guys through moves until I got comfortable with getting back in the ring. For the longest time, I couldn't straighten my right leg out because I had a major, I blew everything out in my right leg when I was working in Louisiana. It was odd. Anyway, I'm getting off on a whole different story there. But I did start wrestling in Louisiana. I blew my knee out in 85, like 2 weeks before Christmas. And my wife was big and pregnant back in Atlanta. You know, I was working, I had an apartment that I split with a couple of guys and was sending money home, and she worked too, but was just on maternity leave and, you know, was going to have our first son anytime. So I called her and I said, "Well, I got good news and I got bad news." And she goes, "Well, give me the good news first." And I said, "Well, the good news is I'm going to be home in about 2 days, but the bad news is my leg is gone and I don't know how bad." You know, so when I come home, I ended up going down to the Houston Clinic was in Columbus, Georgia at the time. And it's Dr. Andrews ran it. But back then it was called the Houston Clinic, and he hadn't moved to Birmingham yet, or he might have been there, but it was just the beginning stages. And he had an office in Columbus too. But one of his doctors did my knee for me. And he told me I was done. I'd never do anything. This is in 1985. He said, "You're done. You'll never do anything athletic again. Be happy that you'll be able to jog lightly, you know, maybe a little bit with your kids, wow, but your lateral movement's gone, you know, and forget the ring." You know, so this is 85, you know, so I was like, wow. And it took me almost 2 years before I had enough, you know, before I could start dabbling around getting in the ring. When I got in, I was training guys. And I thought, wow, I can do this a little bit. Then I got to where I started actually working out in the ring, wrestling with guys. And by the time I got to doing that, the spot opened up in WCW because Teddy Long was becoming a manager and they needed somebody to fill in that. So once again, Pop threw my name in. A lot of my breaks came because Pop was there and threw my name into the hat. And they were like, "Oh, he's available? Okay, cool." You know, it got me a lot of gigs that way. But awesome. That's how I got back into business again as a referee.
The real deal heel Richie Ray hit us up, and he wants to know, Cassio. That's the first question for me on here, Cassio. How's the ribs? Not the one on the grill either, Nick. And for anybody that didn't see it on my social media at the Cassio Kid. I have broken ribs, Nick. I'm doing this show.
Oh no,
ribs. My wife
Oh man, your combat pay.
We had a foot race, and despite what I look like, which is, 10 pounds of sugar in a 5-pound sack, I can pick them up and put them down when I need to. I got a burst of energy, long energy, but a burst, and we had a foot race and I was about to beat her, and she went ahead and gave me the elbow and the shove. Uh-oh. And I went tumbling, fell, and I am.
You took a bump.
Yeah, I took a hard one.
Oh my goodness!
I broke ribs, and so I'm steroid packed right now.
Got
the Toradol flowing, baby.
Bless your heart, man. I'm gonna have to say this now. You and I are friends. But I'm gonna have to give her props for coming up and turning, going straight heel, and going for the victory. She did what it took to seal the victory. And you got to give her props. Yeah, you got to give her props for that. Anyway.
Yeah, I mean, she said Robin's racing, even though I thought we were in a drag strip.
Oh man,
acted like it was NASCAR and went. She came over my lane, fully just shoved me out of the way.
Oh man, she should have come over after the end and like reached her hand out to help you, and just as you reached up to grab it, pull it back and went, hey, and did the old flare strut away. Then, whoa. She could, since she's done straight up heels, she could have closed it out.
She was NWO then. She had,
oh man, back. Yeah, she didn't spray paint you, did she?
She should have. If she had, man, she would have.
Oh no, my goodness.
I had the black marks from the pavement, from the parking lot we were racing in. It was bad.
Oh, that is bad.
It was bad.
I'm sorry to laugh, but that's Seth, man.
Did you? All you are
very competitive.
She is. I'm not, but she is. That's the problem.
You better start.
You ever broke a rib in your day?
No, not a rib. I've broken my leg. I've broken my wrist. And I've blown all kinds of cartilage and ligaments and stuff out. Sure. But I've never broken that.
The best and the worst part is they go, yep, you got a broken rib. Now go have fun. I mean, all you got to do is,
boy.
It's one of those, let it heal. You know what I mean? They can't do
anything.
Yeah,
I've had some friends that's had that. I know that laughing and breathing and everything you do, it affects. Every move you make, it affects.
Don't make me laugh anymore. You got me laughing.
Oh, okay. More laughter. We're going to be straight up serious from here on out, man.
All right, let's get serious. The big headlines this week, Coach Rosie, Josh Rosenbaum, saw him out in Los Angeles for WrestleMania week. Good to see him. And he said he was loving the show, Nick. And he sent a question in, which was the big show after WrestleMania. Nick, what do you think of Endeavor buying WWE? They are now together. Of course, Endeavor owns the UFC. They bought the UFC and did some changes there. Now they are taking over WWE as well. What's your thoughts on that, Nick?
Well, I think it's interesting. I know that it seemed as if Vince and they were preparing the business to move forward in some sort of direction, because they are the trendsetters. And I think it could be a good move, because there's been so much controversy and it's generated him a ton of money. If you think about it, he could probably do just, like he did back in the day when he come in and took over everything at TBS and then sold it and made big money off of it and used that to fund another deal. He might be doing the same. History could be repeating itself. You never know, because he's getting big money for it.
Yeah, I saw a stat. Somebody said, it took around $1 million to take over all the territories. And now he sold it last week for $9.3 billion. That's pretty good turnaround.
Yes, sir. Yeah, that's a pretty good turnaround. Yeah, I'd have liked to have been in on the ground floor of all of that. But nobody made it through that kind of movement. Nobody.
No. What do you think about his mustache? Have you seen him with the stash?
Oh, I love a man. I think he's going for a straight up heel. Look, man, the hair, the everything that's just
like, he looks like a dastardly villain, doesn't he?
Oh, I cracked up. I saw Bill Apter put a picture out on Facebook where he had the fake dark black mustache on, and it cracked me up. But I think it'll set a trend. I think that if they start selling fake dark black mustaches at the WWE matches, that they'll sell a hell out of a lot of them, man.
I like that move. Jeff Ronquillo hit us up at Ad Free Shows. Nick, you are the man. Loving the show, my friend.
Thank you, man. Thank you, sir.
He's got a couple questions. He said, what were the biggest differences working for WCW and WWE? That's the first question. Go ahead with that one, and I'll get the second one.
Okay. At first, at WCW, especially toward the end, there was a lot of subdivision. There were guys having their own private locker rooms and their own buses off to the side, and cliques and politics. I mean, there's going to be politics everywhere. I'm not saying that there wasn't politics in WWE. That man, I get struck by lightning if I said something that stupid. But there was so much politics and getting straight answers and stuff there, especially there toward the end at WCW. It was like they had 92 chiefs and no Indians. You know, it was crazy. But in WWE, there's one really guy that you answer to. And you know, if you want to get the real answer, that's where you go to. You always go to the horse's head. Don't go to the other end. Go to the horse's head to get the straight answer. And they didn't have all that subdivision crap. I mean, even Undertaker dressed in the locker room where guys were, he'd have a spot, you know, where he'd have a room right there by where he was generally with everybody, you know. And, you know, like back when I was, you know, I did the big podcast with Eric and those guys, you know, Hulk had his own room, man, with his own catering, his own everything. And the guy that he worked with would come in there, and the refs didn't go in there. Nobody went in there. No, he lined up what he wanted, and then tell you afterwards what they want. That's not like that WWE, man. It's like a team. There's, you know, there's an agent, there's a referee. Everybody is in on every step of the decision, you know, not the decision making, but the match planning, you know, the mapping out of the match, the decision making is already done, you know, in the background. But and if you want to get an answer, there's, you know, it's easier to get an answer there. And it was like I said, it's more of a team, you know, even amongst between crew and wrestlers, you know, because there's a difference, you know, there. But they seem more of a cohesive unit up in WWE than they did in WCW. Not all the time, because we had great crew members, and I'm not blaming them for it. It was just that there was a subdivision there. And, you know, they come from sports production, and we were wild-ass wrestlers that was making a shitload of money all of a sudden, you know. Yeah. There was a difference, you know. That to me was the main difference. It was more like a team, and you could, like I said, there was one head, one answer. You know, you could at WCW, you could get four or five different answers for the same damn question, and be like, oh geez, you know, even for the same finish, I found out, you know, you could get at least three
notoriously for the same finish.
You know, so I found that out the hard way. You know, but that, you know, something like that would never happen up there. You know, but so that to me was more organized, more strictly run, but that's the way it should be. You know, it's live television, man. You can't just be winging it and running out there last second and just playing. Well, you know, it's live television. You gotta be able to wing it at times, but you gotta have structure. You can't just go out there with and just wing everything. You know, it's not on live television.
And his second question says, what was the biggest struggle being on the road so much? I mean, that's a lot for a lot of people is, you know, every single night going to another town, or every other night going to another town, sleeping in another hotel. Yeah. It's tough being on the road so much.
Yeah. For me, I loved the road as a young guy, but once I had kids is when it really became really hard for me. And, when it became super, super hard for me is when I found out that one of my kids was special needs. And at first I didn't know what was wrong, and was going through testing and trying. I'd never heard of autism before. You know, I'd never heard of it. I didn't know what the hell it was. And all of a sudden my younger son is just talking circles around my older son and doing stuff. My older son was always very independent. If he wanted some hell, he just could do it. He wouldn't ask you if we did do it, you know?
Right.
But we didn't think a lot about it, you know, but now all of a sudden Tony, his younger brother, was just so much more talking, you know? So we started trying to find out what was going on. You know, we've got all kinds of tests, and to me, that is the hardest part of the road. When you have things at home that you need to tend to, but right. You have to, you know, and I quite frankly, I could not, because at the time that my son grew up, insurance didn't pay for a damn thing for autism. So everything that I did for my son, I paid for out of pocket. My parents helped me with, and I paid them back. You know, it was, you know, but there was no insurance. So I had to have my job. You know, I had to protect my job. I couldn't have made that kind of money doing, you know, in the regular real world. You know, that's especially that WCW level money and WWE level money.
Sure.
Hell, even Georgia Championship Wrestling level money. You know, I mean, I made more money as a referee in Georgia Championship Wrestling as I did as a wrestler for, you know, the couple of territories that I went to, because I mean, it was hot.
Yeah.
And that's why a lot of times, if you look back at old wrestling cards from like at Mid-Atlantic and from Florida, different places, you see huge names in the opening matches and stuff, you know? And
yeah.
That's because they could go on down there and be on the first, second, or third match and make more money than they could being in the main event in other places.
That's,
you know,
crazy.
Yeah, that's why you would see things like that, you know. And if you look back and you see stuff, but anyway, well, hell, I forgot what the original question.
So being on the road, you weren't there.
Oh,
you
yeah,
weren't there when you needed to be.
Yeah, that to me was the hardest part. You know, you have certain things you have to try to take care of at home and you keeps it with you everywhere you, because you're gone on the road and you can't, you know, that's on your mind the whole time. The only time it ever really escapes you is when you step through the ropes and the bell rings and you're performing and you're doing your performance in front of people, and your mind and your everything about you is focused on what you're doing in the ring. You forget about all problems and all everything. You just are completely engulfed in what you're doing, and it gives you an escape for a little while. You know, all that stuff's still there once you take a shower and cool down, and you're, you know, and boom, and you get back in, you know, it'll all still be there. But you know, at least you can get away from it for, you know, from bell to bell. That's what I used to tell John Laurinaitis. I say, man, bell to bell, there's nothing in the world like being a professional wrestler. It's just all this other crap in between. It's the getting there. It's the getting back home. It's,
yeah,
it's the office politics. It's, you know, I said, it's all the BS. But bell to bell, man, there's nothing else like it.
Gotta love it. Ron Ward says, hey, Nick.
Yes, sir.
He says, any good Klondike Bill stories? He's a legendary pervert in these parts. There's nothing you could tell us that we'd find shocking, even though that's exactly what we're looking for. So, Nick, any crazy Klondike Bill stories?
No, not really. Klondike was an older guy. I never known him to be like a pervert or anything. In fact, the only really kind of Klondike Bill story that I remember as a kid is they were trying out parts for the people trying out for the Deliverance movie when they were filming.
Oh,
and that part where the rednecks get attacked and ass raped this one guy, you know, it's like, so anyway, I believe it was Klondike that was up for a reading for that. And he was like, no way, man. You know, I'm not, no, it couldn't. He didn't
want to do that role.
No, well, he wasn't going to do that part. He wasn't going to that scene.
Wow.
That scene. It was the scene, you know, that was a heavy scene, you know, especially with that era and time, man.
Well,
for any era and time. But back then, oh man, that was pretty dang heavy, you know.
The fans of ad-free shows and some of the other podcasts, there's been stories floated around Klondike that have been.
Oh, really? Yeah. He was old. He was always an older ring guy, and he traveled with Gordon, yep, Nelson, and I had all the respect in the world for him because he was old and he was busting his ass. And those old WCW rings, they were big, heavy rings, man, that turned the corner posts. Man, that's a two-man job, those corner posts. And him and old Gordon Nelson, they were older guys, man, and their bodies had been all beat up for the business, and they were hauling those heavy-ass rings all around and up and down. Man, I was like, holy crap. Until Pop bought a bunch of those rings when WCW closed down, and I had to help him move like five or six rings into this big storage area. I was like, oh my God. And I realized the magnitude.
How much they were doing.
Oh yeah. The man, those guys, man, I said, holy crap. Those guys deserve, man, some big props for that. Cause it's hard enough to set up a regular ring, but those old WCW rings, man, they were, I guess they were designed off old Crockett style rings. But they were just big, thick, heavy rings, and the planks that went across were actually big cross beams with metal hook gimmicks bolted down onto these cross beams. That's what the floor was running across. It wasn't like layers of boards. It was like incredibly heavy ring. And those old timers was hauling those rings, man. But as far as pervert stories, man, I'm kind of glad
you missed it.
Oh yeah, because knowing Klondike and knowing him as an old guy, I don't even want to hear a story like that about
it. I'll show you some later. You can.
Oh no,
okay. You'll have a good time with us. He also says Ron's a listener because I know he's a listener because of this next question. He said, also on a previous episode, you mentioned that Buzz Sawyer was more than a little nuts. How about a good Buzz Sawyer story?
Oh. Wow.
You got too many.
Buzz, I don't want to bury the guy because I kind of like the guy. But okay. There's a guy that works here in Georgia named Chick Donovan. And, you know, he's in his 70s now. He's still doing shows. And and for his age, man, he still looks great. You know, but he's in his 70s. I mean, wow. Come on, you know. But anyway, it's back in the day when Buzz and Tommy were about to start igniting that feud where they fought through the ring and out through over cars and they had their big it was the big Buzz Sawyer Tommy Rich feud was coming up. And they were getting Buzz ready for it and they were feeding some people to him. And we were in Augusta, Georgia, and they had Chick come out and work with Buzz. So they went out and you know, Chick's one of those guys, man, he wants to get all his stuff in, you know, regardless of what the position and spot is, or, you know, but anyway, they went out and Buzz kind of guzzled him up. That's what he was supposed to do. You know, that's what the boss, that's what Ole wanted him to do, told him to do. That's what Chick was brought there for. But Chick, in his mind, I guess he wanted to get some of his shit in, and he didn't get to. You know, Buzz just guzzled him up. So we're in the back, and I'm standing there, and Chick walks up to Buzz and said, "What the hell was that out there, man?" And Buzz looked at him, and Chick open hand went pow, and he slapped Buzz Sawyer right in the face.
Is Chick a big guy?
No, he's about Buzz's height.
Okay, they're about the same size.
Yeah, about the same size, but Buzz was thicker, just Chick was leaner, you know. He slaps Buzz in the face. Buzz looks at me, because I'm standing right there, and he goes, this weird ass sounded like he was like demented laugh. And he snatched Chick and grabbed him around the waist and belly to belly him right on the concrete there. Just went boom, whoop, bam, and took him down and just snapped just like that, man. And I'm standing and I watched this unfold in front of me, and I was like, holy crap. You know, it's like, what in the hell was Chick thinking in the first place? Now Chick's going to be mad, and I'm going to break his heart about this, but he was brought there to get Buzz over. And Buzz was getting ready to do this blood feud fight through, and they wanted him to be strong. And, you know, and so he did what he was supposed to do. And you know, maybe somebody just didn't tell Chick that, you know, and I give him props for having enough guts to walk up and slap Buzz in the face, but holy crap, he got planted for it, man.
Buzz Sawyer in the face. Yeah,
but that goofy, just demented laugh that he looked at me was like, I was like, what the hell? And then he was, bam, it happened like lightning fast. I'm like, holy crap. But, that was really kind of my only real Buzz story. One time, actually, I had this kid, this big kid. I was up in Ohio. I was the smallest guy always. You know, I was the ref. And if we were all out as a group, I was the smallest guy. So if somebody was going to jump one of somebody in the group, it was usually me. So, and I always had heat. I was young. I was kind of cocky. But there was this this young kid. He looked like a football player. We were doing this college somewhere in West Virginia. And he was just giving me a whole ration of shit. And I was like, you know, and I was like, what are you going to do? And I started, you know, so we started having words. So all of a sudden he gets up and he starts sitting and he's getting a pop from the people. So he says, he invites himself on down the ring. I said, well, bring it. So now he jumps up on the apron now, right? Now here's this kid. He ain't never got into the ring before. And he didn't know really how to step through the rope. So he didn't step through foot first. He kind of come under head first. And when he did, I punted him, poof. And I bum rushed him. I grabbed him by his hair. And I like had him, you know, the top rope. And I was rabbit punching him as fast as I could. Now Buzz was on the way to the ring because he's the next match coming out, right? So Buzz comes and he grabs a kid by the ankles and snatches him off the apron. And he goes to hit him. He looks at him. I had to split the kid's eye open. I got some old knobby ass knuckles, you know, and I rabbit punched him over his eye about four or five times, man. And Buzz went to hit him and he saw his eye was split open. And then the cops swarmed the kid and took him out the door. And he looked at me, gave me that goofy ass laugh again. Like, he goes, you split him open. That's really my only two Buzz stories.
Awesome.
Well, him and Iron Sheik one time when we was in Georgia Championship Wrestling, I don't know what the deal was. Ronnie Garvin was there, and they had this contest to see who could spend the least money in a week, man. And, I mean, there were some dives that we would stay
spend
at.
The least money in the
yeah,
week.
Yeah, and there were some dives that we stayed at, man. I mean to tell you, and Buzz split a room with Iron Sheik one night, and they got to drinking. And I guess, you know, because both of them were shooters. They were going to, and Iron Sheik was, oh, no man can turn the Sheik from his belly to his back. And Buzz was sure too. Well, they got all drunk and they shot in his room and they tore up that room. Every piece of furniture, the beds, the lamps, the ottoman, every piece of furniture in the room was broken. And they had to end up paying for it, and Ole got on everybody's ass, and we never went to that hotel again. But that was kind of a blessing because it was a dive.
That was one you wanted to get mad.
Oh yes, man! Like if you get in trouble there, then you really, you
know, you really. Do we know who won in the fight?
We didn't see it. And neither one of them come out like all. You know, it was just, they were just wrestling.
Just
it wasn't
up.
A fight. Yeah, it wasn't a rip your eye and bop fight and punching.
Just
it was a shoot.
Yeah.
It was a wrestle thing. But, man, they demolished the room, man. And they had to pay for it.
Amazing. Yeah. Jeff Fisher said, Nick, who, in your opinion, had the best mullet in the business? He's got two questions. There's your first. Who's got the best mullet? Who had it back in the day?
Eddie Guerrero.
Oh, such a good one, man.
Yeah.
Fit him
Brad
perfect.
Armstrong, too. Brad Armstrong.
Brad Armstrong's a
super
good,
mullet. Yeah, super mullet.
Jeff also says, any thoughts on who some of the best refs were prior to the cable TV era that began in the early 80s? Maybe who's some that we didn't get a chance to see if, you know, back then it was all territories and local TV. Who's some of the best refs back in pre-cable days?
Pop had, so there were some guys down in Florida that were really good. Because I didn't work with them, I couldn't tell you their name, and I was really young. But in Georgia, there was Charlie Smith and Bobby Simmons, and a guy that helped me out a lot that was reffing actually when I first started, and I kind of slid into his spot because he wanted to go into the office and kind of get out of the ring, was a guy named Ronnie West. And I learned a lot. You know, from all of those guys, even because Charlie Smith was a friend of my dad's, and I knew him ever since I was a little boy. And Pop would take me on the road with him in the summertime. Every now and then, Charlie was one of the guys that would ride with him. And I never forget one time was riding down to Savannah, Georgia, and Pop was he was driving, and Charlie Smith was in the back seat sleeping, and I kept seeing all these pine trees with these little knots on them and little buckets. I didn't know what the hell it was. You know, I asked Pop, and he said, well, they're draining out the pine sap. And I said, what for? He goes, well, hell, I don't know. So Charlie's in the back seat asleep. And so like a lull, about 45 minutes went by, and I guess he was kind of dreaming in what we said. And all of a sudden out of the silence, he blurted out, turpentine. Real loud, man. It's like scared the crap out of me. And I looked at Pop, and Pop looked at me, and we started laughing. It's like, the buckets. That's what he's talking about. So Pop was ready for Charlie to wake up, man. Charlie's back there sleeping. So he looks over at me. I'm like in about the fifth or sixth grade. He goes, he called me Joey. He goes, hey, Joey, you want to drive? I'm like, yeah, pup, I'll drive. And Charlie come out of that back seat like his butt was on fire. No, hell no, I'll drive. I'm awake, I'll drive.
All of a sudden he was ready.
Yeah, he's ready to go, man. He was ready to make a comeback.
All right, Drew Landry wants to know, Nick, you were the ref when Scott Hall invaded Nitro in 1996. Walk us through that scene. What did you know? What were their cues? What did you know going in?
We pretty much knew what the scoop was. You know, they made a big kayfabe deal out of they kayfabe the crew, but they let us know what we were when we was going out there.
Did you know that day? Or did you know beforehand?
No, I just knew before I went out. I didn't know okay. Early that day when I showed up to the building. I didn't know.
Oh, wow. So before you went out, they said, here comes Scott Hall, by the way.
Well, when they lined up what we was doing before we went out, everybody, we don't take care of everybody's finish in front of you. Everybody goes to themselves when they line their finishes up. So, you know, we knew what was happening. We knew what to expect. But, they were trying to kayfabe everybody because they wanted to get a spontaneous reaction from all the crew and everybody to get a real pop.
Yeah.
You know, but there's only so much surprise you can do, especially with live TV, they wasn't like they were cueing us through the earpiece. Okay, here it comes, we knew what to expect, it's just a matter of waiting for it to happen.
And then last but not least, Bryant Haremza has got a couple questions for him. So we appreciate Brian chiming in. He said, Nick, Starrcade was always considered the WrestleMania of WCW by the fans.
Yes.
Did the wrestlers and referees think the same thing, or was there another show they considered bigger?
No, pretty much the same. Everybody thought that. Yeah. They bill every pay-per-view as the biggest thing since sliced bread, but that in actuality was, the one that they put the most oomph into, most of the time. So yeah, we pretty much thought of it the same way. They didn't put as much into it, as much detail into it as any WrestleMania that I've ever been a part of. But,
what would you say? Well, anything close? Would you say there's a second? What was it? Or were the rest of them kind of on par with each other after Starrcade?
They were all pretty much
the same.
Yeah. Yeah. My opinion.
Yeah. And then Brian also wants to know, Nick, has there ever been any historic wrestling venues that you looked forward to refereeing in? Was there one that you were awestruck to perform in?
Yeah, a couple of them. I liked, because I knew that my dad worked some of the buildings. I loved this working in Superdome down in Louisiana as a wrestler. I knew that my pop had been there part of it as a sellout.
Incredible.
But some of the buildings I've got to work in, man, the old Kiel Auditorium and that down in St. Louis and the Royal Albert Hall in London.
Really?
Yeah.
Man, that's super historic venue.
The old Boston Garden.
Did you do Madison Square? Of course.
Yes, I have worked.
Did you Madison like it? Square. I've heard a lot of people in the business didn't like it.
Well, it's just an older building. If you're expecting this huge grand palace, it's not that. It's an older venue, but.
You can appreciate what happened in there, the history.
The history is just so incredible. There's so many levels to it. There's different theaters, different, parts of the garden. But the garden itself, it's not this grand palace that you would expect out of a modern building. But you go there for the history, in my opinion.
And last but not least, I got a personal question since we had our last mailbag, Nick. We kind of hinted about it before, but they had the wrestling, the WWE Hall of Fame ceremony, and Tim White was announced as the first referee to go in. Just your thoughts on him getting that and your thoughts on Tim White while we're here.
Tim White is a great guy. He was tremendous. I'm one of the few guys that can say that they have been to the Friendly Tap and had a cold beer. I have been there. Yes, I sure did. Me and Teddy Long went there.
That's awesome.
And Tim was a great guy, and I had all the respect in the world for him and his contribution to the industry. He deserved it, and he did a lot of things above and beyond being a referee. You know, he'd worked his way, and he was an agent when I was there. He was still reffing when I first got there, but he was an agent, you know, until they released him. And what a super guy, you know. He took care of Andre, and he did so many things. He was just a super nice guy, you know, and somebody you'd want to stay on the good side of too. You know, Timmy was, I knew that he could go if he had to, but I never saw that out of him. You know, it was always just such a super nice, easy to get along with super guy. And I'm really glad for him. And it's cool that a ref finally did, you know. It's I really didn't think they ever would.
Yeah.
But I'm really glad they did. And if they do another one, I'm sure it'll probably be like one of the Hebners or somebody, you know, because people asked me before who I thought, and it probably was on one of our mailbag questions.
Yeah, it was our last one. Yeah.
Yeah. And I told them to take a watch that match where Dave Hebner is the referee with Macho Man and Ricky Steamboat. That's a ref working and fitting in with two workers that are working a turbocharged match, and he's right there with every step, every beat of it, you know. So to me, you know, that performance alone, you know, with the pressure and the magnitude of the guys that he was working with and the company he was working for in that position and that show and that match, that was a lot. He'd come out. That is something that you would study as a young ref. If you want to learn how to do live television, live pay-per-views, that's a match you should watch.
Nice. Well, brother, it's been a fun one, man. I appreciate you joining me, brother.
Well, thank you very much for having me, man. This is a lot of fun, man. And I get to do it. I get to stay still close to home, and I get to come over here and hang out at my son's house for a little bit with him and chill. And, then I can walk right across the Hamilton compound, and it's raining, so I brought my truck over here this time, so I didn't want to scurry across and get my feet wet, man, because that's a big-ass yard I got to go run across, man.
What's going on with GC Dub? Or Deep South, man, I mean.
GC. No, we're Deep that's South. Okay, man. We're doing good, man. We're getting ready for our tournament. We just ran a little show in Dalton, Georgia. It did so-so, but I had a really cool thing happen to me up there, man. It wasn't really so much wrestling. Yeah, it was all wrestling, man. My son, Nick, 37 years old, autistic. He never, ever voluntarily ever would step into the ring ever. And when he was a little boy, we'd try to set him through the ropes if he wanted to go in and play. And he'd be like, yeah, he just didn't want no part of it, man. And as a young man, And he'd watch me train people. I was, hey, Nick, you want to get in here? No. And so anyway, I go to a show in Dalton, and I bring the new DSW title with me, which I'll probably have with me at the next time here, so I can show it to everybody.
Yeah.
But I took it up there to show everybody. So I'm behind a curtain, and they're about to call me to come out, and Nick's standing with me. I said, hey, Nick, I said, do you want to come out there and hold the title and come out with me? He goes, yes, I will. So, okay, it really surprised the crap out of me, right? So I threw the title over his shoulder. I said, okay, let's go. So we walked right through the curtain, and we went out to ringside. As we stood there at ringside, I looked at him. I said, hey, do you want to just stand right here and talk, or do you want to jump up into the ring with me? You know, because, you know, as a parent of an autistic kid, you're always trying to get him to try to do different things and to push your boundaries. Well, man, he's 37 years old, never, ever wanted to get in the ring. And I asked him that, and he looked right straight at me and said, yes, I will get in the ring. And I was like, oh, so I held my hand out. He handed me the title, and he jumped right in the ring like he knew what he was doing. And I handed him the title back, and I climbed right in like I was old and hurt and couldn't make it hardly. So we get in the ring, and we cut our little promo. And during the promo, I walked over to Nick. I put my arm around him, and I said, hey, Nick, tell everybody we are Deep South. I held the microphone to him, and not only did he climb into the ring, he said, we are Deep South on the microphone. Yes. And I really popped for that. And then the other guy that was in the ring with me, we finished out the little promo. And then I said, hey, Nick, show everybody the title. And he took the title and held it up over his head and showed it to everybody in the crowd.
Perfect
and
move.
And then pulled it back down. Yeah, man. And jumped right out of the ring and went and sat down and waited for me. And they closed out the promo, and we were done, man. And I was so wrapped up into doing the promo, and I knew the magnitude of what had just happened. But man, once we got riding back home, I thought about what happened, man. It teared me up a little bit. You know, I mean, I sound like a big sap now, you know, but man, that was, it was a big moment, you know, and to me that it didn't matter if we'd have had 10,000 people or 11 people there, you know, that got to happen for me. And it was worth that long butt drive all the way up to North Georgia, man. And it was a little ride, man. I hadn't made a trip in a minute. And the Dalton was like right next to Chattanooga. It's like they're kissing cousins.
Yeah. You know,
they're so close. But but it was cool, man. It was a really good night, and we had fun listening to some rock and roll on the way up there and some rock and roll on the way back. We had a hell of a time, man.
How about, man, this deep into your wrestling career and still having first in moments like that?
Yeah,
that's what
man.
It's all about, man.
Yeah, it's an incredible business, and it does incredible things.
That's awesome. Well, tell me about you do have a tournament coming up. When's that?
Yeah, we hadn't scheduled it yet. We got the people lined up. We're still working on the building, but we've got the title now. And two of the guys that were in it were injured, and one is ready to roll. The other one should be in another week or so. And sure, within 2 or 3 weeks now, we'll have
so hopefully a date in lined April.
Up. Yeah. We'll have a date lined up, and we're going to start plugging it. And we will crown a new Deep South Wrestling champion coming up very soon. And I'll have the title on our next mail.
All right.
So
that's what we want.
See what the title looks like.
We cool. want to see the strap next time, my man.
I'm going to have it, man. I'll have Nick come bring it. No, I can't bring Nick. Nick is glued to the TV over there right now, man, with Danny. And it's so funny because my mom's fallen a couple of times. Nick's seen it, you know, so I'm always on her about her walker, but, you know, bless her heart. I'd rather be mad at me about it and then forget it and fall right. and get hurt, you know. So Nick's got where he stooges her right off, man. If I'm outside or something, my phone will ring, "Hey, Dad, Nanny's trying to do the laundry. Nanny's trying to do the dishes."
he's riding her out.
Yeah, man. He's stooging her right off, man. Yeah.
You gotta love it.
Yeah, so I got help, man. I got help.
Great stuff. Everybody, thank y'all for sending in questions. This would be a short episode if y'all didn't send in questions. So thank y'all for doing that every single week, every single other week, right here at Ad Free Shows. So make sure you follow us on social media at Ad Free Shows. You can also follow me at The Casio Kid. Tell them how they can find Deep South. Facebook, right?
Yes, sir. And you can check us out on YouTube/ We Are Deep South. You can pull up our bunch of our different matches. You know, our different match. Every match is a main event, so you can. They each have a name, so check them out. We've got some really good stuff out there right now.
Check that out on the YouTube. We Are Deep South, and also when this drops and you're listening to it and you have fun, be sure to leave us a comment, leave us some feedback, and leave us a question for next episode. For Mr. Nick Patrick, I am Casio. We appreciate you joining us here on Monday Mailbag with the man, the myth, the legend, Nick Patrick, baby.